Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Today, award-winning filmmaker Len Kamerling on the roots of culture and understanding.
You know, when I hear things like a registry for Muslim people, well, you know, that's how things started in Germany in the 30s, just with a registry.
I hope you'll join us. Next Thursday, April 20th at noon, my guest on this episode, Leonard Kamerling, will talk about preserving Alaska's visual history. You see, besides crafting some of the most deeply penetrating documentary films about Alaska Native culture, he also serves as film curator for the University of Alaska Museum of the North. Perhaps his best-known film, The Drums of Winter, is in the Library of Congress's National Film Registry. However, he's created other wonderful examinations of cultures and personalities, including a documentary on the composer John Luther Adams. His most recent work, Changa Revisited, looks at the life of a Maasai tribesman over the course of 30 years. It recently garnered a win at an international film festival in Romania. I began our discussion by asking Len about the film and the festival.
This festival is one of the largest festivals in Europe, one of the kind of three largest, and it's in Romania. So it features lots of Eastern European films, films that we never get to see here. So being there was kind of wonderful because I got to see all of these Eastern European films and meet the filmmakers, and that was very, very inspiring.
Was it a specific, oftentimes there's a specific award for a particular aspect about a film. Yeah. And what was this one?
Well, in this festival, there were over 2,000 films that were entered. 100 films were chosen. And within those 100 films, there were four categories. Best Romanian film, best student film, best Eastern European film, and then the main prize was best international film. And that's the category that we won in. We competed against nine other finalists. And we were very surprised because the film that I picked for the winner was not mine.
Well, so I'm not going to you if I ever need a tip on a horse race. Romania. Does your family come from Romania or that neck of the woods?
Yes. My father came from the far north, what was Romania. The borders changed. And the city that he grew up in is called Chernivets, which used to be a real kind of cultural and commercial center and a center for Jewish culture. And that border changed. And now that city is in the Ukraine. But it used to be in Romania, but it was a German-speaking area, a Saxon area, from the old days, like the 12th century days. But he left when he was a teenager. This was in the 20s, and that town was was basically the Jewish presence there was, you know, wiped out during the Holocaust.
Did you still have family there?
No. The family that we had there, the few survivors went to Israel, but most of the people, you know, perished during the war.
Yeah, really horrific. When your father left Romania, where did he settle?
They settled in New York, and he had a small film distribution company and a small library that grew. And he had, you know, it was a kind of library that had various clients that dealt with him. For example, you know, the American Heart Association produced information films, and they needed somebody to distribute them. So he was that. And they also had a collection of independent films as well. And one of the films that they had was by John Marshall, who was, you know, an early ethnographic filmmaker. A film called The Hunters, which was about a group of Kalahari bushmen off on a giraffe hunt. And I saw that film when I was in high school. It made a big impression on me. And, you know, I would often call my dad at work and say, oh, you know, bring home The Hunters and Laurel and Hardy. And, you know, and we had a projector And so, you know, I would like fake having a sore throat and stay home and watch movies all day.
How great is that?
Yeah.
Now, how big was your family? Do you have siblings?
Right, I have an older brother and a younger sister, and you know, many, many cousins all over the place now.
And so in some ways, your future vocation really was set quite early in a way. Do you think your father's film library and occupation influenced your direction in life?
I'm sure it did. Just being around that world and being around the sort of the, you know, the world of film and the smell of the film and the sort of tactile, you know, part of how it feels. And he also worked as a projectionist in theaters in New York. So I spent, you know, a lot of my childhood in various projection booths in, you know, in New York City. It's sort of a sensory world, that the projection booth of a theater. It's noisy, it has a certain smell to it, and those are very, very much burned into my memory.
Now, you went to the London Film School.
I went to the London Film School.
Why those, there?
In those days, it was called the London School of Film Technique. I went there because by that time, I knew I was interested in documentary film. And the American film schools were much more geared towards Hollywood and fiction filmmaking. And it was also much cheaper than any of the American schools. And I went there, and it was a really good choice. It was in Covent Garden in an old converted banana warehouse. But the school was very poor, and in making our student films, you know, they would give us a budget, and we had to stay within that budget, and we were not permitted to use our own money for in any way, which was wonderful because it just evened the playing field, and that was very good. You know, film schools generally don't teach the business side of filmmaking. They don't teach, you know, making a budget, writing a proposal. And so that was very valuable early training.
Is there a mentor or a professor or someone that comes to mind that inspired you from that period?
Yeah, you know, this was in the 60s, in the late 60s, and it was the time in Eastern Europe of, you know, when the Eastern European countries were still under Soviet dominance, and it was a time right after the Prague Spring, when the Soviet Union kind of moved in to crush the liberalization in Czechoslovakia, and many filmmakers left. And so the faculty at the London Film School had many of these Czech, you know, refugees, people that had gone to the Czech film school, FAMU, which was, you know, one of the, recognized as one of the best in the world. And so that was a very, very lucky experience for me to have these advisors, these Czech filmmakers who came out of the Czech new wave of the 60s in that tremendous, you know, blossoming of creativity in film, and really a time of breaking the barriers and the parameters of filmmaking, what film meant.
This is Northern Soundings. My guest today is filmmaker Len Kamerling. As you'll hear, his sensibilities were deeply formed by his boyhood experiences and his participation as a VISTA volunteer. It seems to me you always, in all the work that I've seen of yours, have a deep sensitivity to and seem drawn to other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Maybe part of the reason is because I grew up around an immigrant culture. My grandparents are from, you know, what's now Belarus, and they spoke very choppy English. And I grew up around a lot of people from from Eastern Europe and from Europe. And so in that milieu, you have, you know, parents who have hopes for their children and expect certain things of their children based on the values of how they grew up. And the children are not of that culture, really. They're assimilated American kids. And so there's always this kind of push and pull that, you know, as I got older, I saw this is just, it's a typical American story. It is the American story of immigrants coming, wanting to maintain their culture and their value, and the next generation breaking from that and going off to establish their lives. And, you know, you see that repeated over and over and over and over again.
Based on your ability to identify with culture and establish relationship, it must be deeply disquieting to see where the political landscape is going in our country.
It's alarming. You know, when I hear things like a registry for, you know, for Muslim people, well, you know, that's how things started in Germany in the 30s, sort of just with a registry. It's kind of unbelievable that, you know, that people don't see that echo from, you know, from that time and reflection from that time. And this whole anti-immigrant fervor, I think this is an immigrant country. And that's its greatest strength. And it's also, you know, maybe its greatest problem. But it's something that's in, that's what this country is. You know, it's at the basic building blocks of, you know, what America is. So it's very upsetting and very disquieting. The demagogues go for, you know, the easiest target, the weakest group.
You came to Alaska as a VISTA volunteer?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that. How did that work?
Well, I had finished 2 years of college. The college that I went to, which my parents found just by accident, was a new kind of Antioch-style college in New Hampshire being organized by some sort of education radicals from Cambridge, from Brandeis, and from Harvard. It was a very wonderful place for me because I kind of, you know, discovered that I, you know, had an intellect. I started to discover, you know, myself and my abilities and my interests there.
So VISTA Volunteer is a social kind of program. And so what did you hope when you came here?
Well, you know, I was in a bus in New York and I came to this one ad and it said, "We're looking for deviants." And that caught my eye. And then it said, "Are you dissatisfied with America? You know, do you want to change poverty?" And so the ad kind of grabbed my attention. And this was an ad for VISTA, which was brand new at the time, and still quite undefined, I think. And I joined, and I thought, well, it would be great to, you know, work on an Indian reservation. I was sent to Utah, and in Salt Lake City, was going to work on a Ute reservation, and I was in a training program there. And then a week into this, in a class, some guy, you know, in a suit comes into the class and says, "We're starting a new program in Alaska. Does anybody want to go?" I raised my hand. 48 hours later, I was here.
No kidding. What, were you prepared for what you found?
No. And, you know, I don't know why I raised my hand. I did. And that set a completely different course for, you know, for my life, the rest of my life.
And creatively, when did you first decide to take up and produce films on Alaska Native peoples?
Well, it's during this first year living in a Native village, this year as a VISTA volunteer. I was photographing and thinking a lot about the power of the photograph and where that power ended.
Do all filmmakers start out as still photographers?
No, I don't think they do, but my path was moving me to, you know, to be a filmmaker. And I think it was very fortuitous because still photography really taught me about composition and about light and about framing and about, you know, what what Cartier-Bresson calls the decisive moment, when all of the elements come together in a photograph to make, you know, a moment that's indelible and unforgettable. That's essential training for, you know, for a filmmaker. So when I started to make my first films, that early training in photography was very, very useful. But the real change came afterwards when I was back, afterwards when I was back in New York and went back to school for a short time. I started looking at films about the North, about, you know, Canadian Inuit people, about Alaska, and about other ethnographic films as well. And they all were so different than my experience. They seemed to be concerned with the exterior world of people, what they did, how they did it, you know, the man against the environment. And there was no even, you know, no acknowledgement that there was an inner life as well. You know, that there was this emotional landscape, not just the physical landscape. And so I started to think about that, how all of these filmmakers had missed this or never saw it. And the idea of how an outsider would approach that. How would you make a film about another culture that group felt that represented them? So, you know, that idea just stayed with me. And when I came back again to Fairbanks, I started to put this together into a real idea and a real plan. And I met somebody who worked at what was then the Eskimo Language Workshop. And a young guy named Andy Chikoyak from Tununuk on Nelson Island. And he got permission from Tununuk for us to come and work there. I raised some money. It was the end of the fiscal year, and I was working at the university in what was then the Center for Northern Educational Research. And the director, Frank Darnell, said, it's the end of the year. I know the BIA has some, you know, end of the year funds. I'll get you a ticket to go down there and, you know, talk to them. So I did. And, you know, I came back with enough money to make the film.
You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This episode, I'm talking with award-winning filmmaker Len Kamerling. Len's films often coalesce around a distinctive personality. This is true of Heart of the Country, a wonderful examination of an elementary school principal in Hokkaido, Japan. I asked Len about his approach to visual storytelling.
I called this community collaborative filmmaking. And in this first effort in Tununuk, you know, I had a kind of written methodology, step one, you know, do this. But within a week, that was all out the window. And the reality of being there was much different than, you know, thinking of it in advance. But I did know some things that turned out to be true. One was that you can't predetermine the subject of the film without being there, without the experience of being there, influencing that process and that decision. So, you know, instead of like normal films where you kind of write a scenario and you have a plan and then you go and, you know, you get those shots, this was more like putting yourself in the current of the village and seeing where it took you, establishing relationships and establishing trusts. And from those trusts, from those friendships, doors would open and the film and the story would present itself and become obvious. So, one of the things that I did learn in film school, the teacher once told me in talking about documentaries, is that friendship and trust, that's the key. That's what the film is really about. And David McDougall, who's a very well-known visual anthropologist and filmmaker, has once said that, you know, what an ethnographic film is always about is the relationship between the filmmaker and the subject.
I'm thinking of Strange and Sacred Noise with John Luther Adams. Mm-hmm. Very much the power in these movies is the personality of the central character. But with Strange and Sacred Noise, you often say that you learn to trust about an open-ended conclusion. Has your approach to storytelling changed, do you think, over time, Len?
I think it has. I'm like much more comfortable with ambiguity. You know, I think the question is always more important and provocative than the answer. And if the film, you know, poses a question that lingers, I think that's successful. In a way, that's what documentary film does best. So in Strange and Sacred Noise, that was a very different kind of film for me because, for one thing, it was of a performance of a piece by John Luther Adams set in the wilderness of the Alaska Range. So the structure of that film was this musical piece, you know, which couldn't be altered. But that was a wonderful experience because it gave me a chance to really let myself loose on making something that was almost purely visual.
If I recall correctly, because we've talked about Django Revisited, there's a period of time where you see the central character in an earlier part of his life, and then you revisit it.
Right. And you know, Django Revisited looks at this one Maasai family from two points in a 30-year divide. So 1980, and then in the present day, which was 2009 when we filmed it. My partner, Peter Biella, who's directs the visual anthropology program at San Francisco State University, he went to Tanzania with his professor in 1980 to do his dissertation work. He wanted to make a film then because he trained as a filmmaker. He asked me to come and do the camera work for him in 1980, but he couldn't raise the money to make a film. And so instead, he took with him a photographer, a very talented young photographer, and they documented this experience in stills, in black and white still photography. But being a filmmaker, what Peter did is every time they photographed, he recorded the sound as if it was a film. So coming out of this period there, you know, he came out with about 6,000 photographs, beautiful black and white photographs, many of them wide lux. Wide lux is a camera with a mechanical shutter that goes 180 degrees. So you get these, you know, these beautiful widescreen photographs with tremendous amount of detail in them. And so there were 6,000 photographs and audio that accompanied those moments, those, you know, sort of perishable moments in a culture, in this family. Peter used a lot of it for his, you know, for his PhD, but the bulk of it just sort of, you know, remained there until we rediscovered it working on Django Revisited.
Hearing you talk, I'm reminded that you're also a curator at the museum, and one of the things a curator does is protect archives and protect documentation that has value. I know many of your films are in the archives. Is there, in this fast-paced digital age, a concern that a lot of this material is just going to disappear?
That's a great question. And yes, probably 90% of it or more will end up on an obsolete hard drive in a box in a basement or just vanish. You know, if you have a cassette of tape or a reel of tape or a reel of film and you put it in a box and put a label on it and put it on the shelf, it's going to be there when you come back. With a digital file, you never know that it's going to be there. They easily get lost. They become corrupt. You know, the wonderful freedom of the digital age and the way that it's been kind of a democratized filmmaking is kind of balanced by the nightmare of what are we going to do with this material. And, you know, when we take digital photographs, we don't take one. You know, we take 5, we take 10 of the same thing. So there is just a huge amount of material. And very few people, maybe nobody, thinks about a strategy for preserving these for after they're gone for the long term. So yeah, most of them will disappear.
Well, you know, you've accomplished so much. You've got a large now body of work behind you. What's ahead for Len Kamerling?
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter Biella and I have a few more smaller films to finish from our Tanzania work. And beyond that, I'm not really sure. You know, I'm considering several ideas. I'm waiting for that idea to just like take hold and like, you know, wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning and refuse to leave. And that's when I know it's something that I'll pursue, because we're going to be locked in a room with this for years. So it has to be something that is really sustaining and that can, you know, is life-changing. Every film should be, and I guess I'm lucky because every film I've made has, in a way, been life-changing.
Well, Len Kamerling, thank you for stopping by and talking with me today.
Thanks, Robert.
That's it for this episode of Northern Soundings. My guest has been award-winning filmmaker Len Kamerling. Many of Len's films are available at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Archives, and his Drums of Winter is on the National Film Registry at the Library of Congress. Until next time, I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Thanks for listening.